March 18th, 1991. Azalea, Oregon. Two-year-old Tommy Gibson goes missing from the front yard of his rural home. Tommy's father, Larry Gibson, claims his son vanished while he was out jogging and that his daughter witnessed Tommy get abducted by an unidentified couple driving a pickup truck. However, investigators discover a number of suspicious discrepancies which make them believe that Larry caused Tommy's death and covered up the crime by disposing of his body. Larry is eventually convicted of second-degree manslaughter and serves nearly 3 years in prison. But he continually maintains his innocence, and no trace of Tommy is ever found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a missing children's case, the 1991 disappearance of two-year-old Tommy Gibson. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Sam Pant, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Sam. This is a recurring contest which we've been holding for over 6 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, the disappearance of Tommy Gibson is a very controversial story which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, but unfortunately, it is not currently available for viewing on the official FilmRise channel on Amazon Prime or YouTube. This may have something to do with the fact that the case is technically considered to be solved, but since the victim has still not been found, and the alleged perpetrator received a very light sentence and has never admitted guilt, there's always been a lot of unanswered questions about the outcome. Tommy Gibson was the son of a sheriff's deputy named Larry Gibson, and he supposedly vanished from the front yard of his rural home, but a search for him turned up nothing, and investigators eventually became suspicious of Larry. While Larry maintained that Tommy was abducted by an outside party, there were some holes in his alibi, and he changed certain details of his story, so investigators began to believe that Larry may have accidentally killed his son and disposed of his body. Larry was eventually charged with Tommy's murder and found guilty at trial, with the primary evidence against him being the testimony of his daughter, who said that she witnessed her father beat Tommy to death in a fit of rage. However, given that she was only 4 years old at the time, Larry's defense team argued that her account was not reliable, and the jury ultimately decided to convict him on the lesser charge of second-degree manslaughter, which meant that he only had to serve less than 3 years behind bars before he was released. To this day, Larry has never stopped maintaining his innocence, and Tommy is still a missing person, and regardless of how you view the case, I think we can all agree that this was a very unsatisfying outcome for everyone involved. So on this episode, we're going to look at both sides of the story and try to figure out what actually happened. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page currently has around 70 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on our regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Tommy Gibson. Thank you. Our story begins in 1991 in Azalea, Oregon, an unincorporated community located in Douglas County near Interstate 5. Our victim is 32-month-old Thomas Dean Gibson, who goes by the name Tommy. Tommy lives with his parents, Larry and Judy Gibson, as well as his older 4-year-old sister Karen, in a mobile home in a rural wooded area known as Cow Creek Valley, which is surrounded by hills and farmland. The Gibsons originally hail from Montana and relocated to Oregon just over 3 years earlier, shortly before Tommy was born. Larry works as a deputy for the Douglas County Sheriff's Office in the town of Glendale, 10 miles away, and his half-brother Michael also happens to be staying at his residence at this point. At around 11:30 a.m. on the morning of March the 18th, Larry left his home to go jogging and claimed that he saw Tommy playing in the front yard by the porch and told him to stay there until his sister came out to play with him. Larry then continued his jog on a private dirt road which went up into the mountains and said that he covered a distance of approximately 2.5 miles before he returned 47 minutes later. However, Judy then informed Larry that she went outside about 10 minutes after he originally left and discovered that Tommy was gone. She initially assumed that Larry might have taken Tommy with him when he went jogging, but this was not the case, so Larry, Judy, and Michael attempted to search for him. When they failed to find Tommy, Larry contacted the Douglas County Sheriff's Office in order to report his son missing. A massive search effort would soon be launched involving over 200 people, including members of law enforcement and volunteers, who used tracking dogs and a U.S. Air Force Reserve helicopter to comb through Cow Creek Valley. But after searching for 3 days, they failed to find any trace of Tommy. A group of volunteers was formed called the Find Tommy Gibson Committee, who used donations in order to print out and distribute thousands of missing persons flyers for the boy. The local authorities began to doubt that Tommy simply wandered off into the woods and feared that he may have been abducted, so the Oregon State Police and the FBI were brought in to assist them with the investigation. On May the 3rd, 6 weeks after Tommy vanished, the Douglas County Sheriff's Office announced that after meeting with the Oregon State Police, they had made the decision to place Larry on administrative leave, and he was indefinitely suspended with pay. They said this was done in order to avoid a potential conflict of interest with the investigation and give Larry a chance to recover from the stress of losing Tommy. Well, 3 weeks later, on May the 23rd, the case took a surprising turn when the Oregon State Police filed a 31-page affidavit in Douglas County Circuit Court outlining a number of reasons why they now considered Larry to be the prime suspect in his son's disappearance. It read, quote, "The likelihood of Tommy Gibson being alive and meeting any fate other than death at the hands of Larry Gibson is extremely small," end quote. This allowed the police to obtain a warrant to perform a search of the Gibson residence, and they seized a number of items, including some guns, telephone records, and a spent .45 caliber shell found inside a dresser underneath a pair of children's underwear. It turned out that Larry did a number of things to raise suspicion on the day Tommy went missing. He had been scheduled to report for duty at the sheriff's office in Glendale at 2 p.m., but was told by his supervisor not to come into work so he could assist in the search for his son. In spite of this, Larry decided to take a shower and put on his police uniform, as he said that he did not believe the situation was that serious at the time and figured that Tommy would be found relatively quickly. When nightfall hit, some of the searchers built a campfire on the Gibson's property until Larry approached them and advised them to go home because it was cold and it was about to start snowing. Needless to say, they found it odd that Larry did not seem overly concerned about the possibility that Tommy might be out there alone in the cold weather. When Larry was interviewed by the FBI several days later, he initially told them that he never left his property on the day Tommy disappeared. However, investigators soon performed a search of Larry's patrol car, which had been parked at the property that day, and while they failed to find any evidence, they noticed that the odometer had registered 7 miles, which could not be accounted for. When the Oregon State Police confronted Larry with this information, he admitted that shortly after putting on his uniform, he did leave his property in the patrol car while the search effort was taking place. He said he was worried that Tommy may have been abducted, so he drove 2.5 miles to the southbound rest area on Interstate 5 to see if he might be there. When he failed to find Tommy, he also checked out the northbound rest area in that vicinity, but once again came up empty. He estimated that he spent between 10 to 15 minutes searching each rest area before returning home. However, this seemed to contradict a story that Judy had shared with investigators, as she said that Larry told her he drove his patrol car into Glendale that afternoon in order to check on his own private car. For her part, Judy denied ever having said this and claimed that the Oregon State Police had twisted her words around. Shortly after Tommy went missing, Larry had agreed to take a polygraph test, and while he technically wound up passing, the results still indicated that he may have known more than he was letting on. Judy also took a polygraph and got the same results, as investigators wondered if she may have secretly suspected her husband, but would not say so during the test. Investigators also had issues with Larry's story about having gone jogging during the time period when Tommy went missing, as he claimed that he covered about 2.5 miles and was gone from his home for 47 minutes. But when they retraced the route that Larry said he took, they determined that it was actually 1 mile, so it only should have taken him about 18 to 20 minutes to jog this distance back and forth between his home. A neighbor of the Gibson family named Jennifer Klein also told police that sometime after 11:30 a.m. on the morning of Tommy's disappearance, she recalled hearing a gunshot, and a short time later, she noticed her cat was missing. While searching for it the following day, Jennifer spoke with Larry, who told her that he feared that he had shot the animal after mistakenly believing it was a stray cat. Well, sure enough, Jennifer soon found her dead cat, and it was buried on her property, but 2 months later, investigators felt compelled to pay her a visit in order to dig up the cat's body. After performing a forensic examination, they discovered that the cat was shot through the heart and lungs, though the bullet had passed right through its body and could not be found. When questioned about this, Larry claimed that when he went jogging on the morning of Tommy's disappearance, he was carrying a .45 automatic handgun in his shoulder holster, which he often had with him whenever he left the property. Larry said that shortly after he left his house, he was about to cross over a fence in his yard when he noticed a cat wandering nearby. According to Larry, he and his neighbors had spent the past several weeks dealing with stray feral cats on their properties, and even though he had attempted to take some of these cats to the Humane Society, he was told they had no room for them. Larry decided that the only solution was to shoot the cats, so he pulled out his .45 and fired a shot at this particular cat. Since he claimed that he last saw the cat running through some weeds down a hill, Larry initially assumed that his shot had missed, but when he realized that Jennifer Klein was searching for her own cat the following day, he realized he had probably killed it. Larry once again gave inconsistent statements about the situation, as he initially told investigators that he picked up the shell casing which was ejected from his handgun when he fired the shot at the cat, but then later told a different investigator that he was unable to find the casing. The shooting of the cat caused the Oregon State Police to formulate a theory about how Larry may have caused Tommy's disappearance. They speculated that when Larry fired the shot, the bullet may have passed through the cat's body and accidentally struck Tommy in the distance while he was playing in the front yard. Larry may not have realized this until after he returned home from his jog, but after discovering Tommy's body, he panicked and started cleaning up the scene. He then proceeded to hide Tommy inside the trunk of his patrol car before calling the authorities to report his son missing. At his earliest opportunity, Larry then drove the patrol car off the property and disposed of Tommy's body at a nearby location. However, Judy's account of that morning seemed to contradict this scenario, as she claimed she recalled hearing the sound of her husband firing his gun, but then also heard Tommy playing on the front porch seconds later, which went against the idea of him being hit by a stray bullet. Regardless, detectives from the Oregon State Police decided to confront Larry with their suspicions and present this theory to him. Larry then provided this odd response, quote, "It could have happened that way, and it's possible, it's the only thing that makes sense," end quote. He also made another odd statement about how his half-brother Michael could have found Tommy's body while he was out jogging and then moved it without his knowledge. However, Larry maintained that he was only speaking hypothetically when he made these statements and denied the allegations that he accidentally shot Tommy and that he or anyone else from his family was responsible for the boy's disappearance. Even though he was publicly named as a potential suspect, Larry returned to active duty with the Douglas County Sheriff's Office in late June, though he would be assigned to their office in the town of Roseburg rather than Glendale. Larry also spent the next few months working as a records clerk before he finally returned to patrol duty. This case would receive national exposure when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired on October the 23rd of that year, only 7 months after Tommy went missing. Larry was the one who reportedly contacted the show and asked him to feature his son's story, and during his interview, he staunchly maintained his innocence and Judy supported him. While the Unsolved Mysteries segment outlined the theory in which Tommy was accidentally shot, they also presented an alternate scenario in which he could have been abducted. 2 weeks after Tommy went missing, investigators were approached by Jeanette Klein, who happened to be the mother-in-law of Jennifer Klein, the neighbor whose cat was shot. Jeanette claimed that on the morning of Tommy's disappearance, she drove down to the end of her driveway and saw an older model, gold or tan-colored pickup truck pass by on Azalea Glen Road. After Jeanette turned right, she tailed the truck for a short distance and noticed the silhouettes of two figures inside the cab. She also said that the most distinctive feature of the truck is that its license plate was in the back window rather than on the rear bumper. The truck soon turned right and headed down the lengthy driveway which led to the Gibson residence, and while she didn't think much of it at the time, Jeanette eventually came to believe that the truck might have had some sort of connection to Tommy's disappearance. However, investigators did not seem to put much stock into Jeanette's story, as she never mentioned the truck during her initial interview with the FBI, so they wondered if she might have misremembered what she saw when she reported the truck a few weeks later. Well, 3 months after Tommy went missing, Larry contacted the authorities and said that his daughter Karen had informed him that she had witnessed Tommy get abducted from their front yard by an unidentified couple. According to Larry, Karen had been looking for a shoe inside her bedroom closet that morning when she looked out the window and saw what she described as a quote-unquote ugly yellow pickup truck pulling into the carport. Karen also said that the truck's license plate was attached to the back window, so it seemed to match the description of the truck Jeanette had seen. Karen then saw what she described as a dark-haired white male with a beard and scruffy clothes, and a white woman with long blonde hair in a braid or a ponytail exiting the truck. The couple proceeded to abduct Tommy from the front yard and put him in their truck before they drove away from the scene. Karen was apparently so frightened by what she saw that she blocked it from her memory for the next few months, and while Judy never personally witnessed anything, she said she did recall hearing what sounded like a vehicle idling near the residence during this time period. But much like with Jeanette Klein, investigators did not put much credence into Karen's story since she had previously been interviewed 3 times and denied seeing anything on the day her brother went missing. The Oregon State Police suspected that when Larry learned the details about Jeanette's sighting of the truck, he fed them to Karen and then coached her into sharing a false abduction story in order to take suspicion off himself. It's also worth noting that the Unsolved Mysteries segment concluded with Robert Stack holding up an anonymous letter which had been sent to the authorities about a month after Tommy's disappearance. It was signed Spot in the Road, and while the letter's contents were kept secret, investigators believed that the author had important information about the case and sent out a public plea in which they guaranteed this person's safety if they came forward. While the Unsolved Mysteries episode did bring in some new tips, none of them had much concrete information to lead the case any closer to a resolution. In January of 1992, Larry decided to formally resign from the Douglas County Sheriff's Office, as Larry said that the stress of the whole situation was forcing his family out of Oregon, so they were going to return to their native Montana. By this point, Judy had become pregnant again, and in April, she gave birth to a daughter named Lisa. The following year, the Gibsons had a third daughter named Christina. In June of 1993, Tommy's story received additional publicity when the band Soul Asylum released a music video for their hit song, Runaway Train. The video contained images of a number of missing children which have been provided by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The final image put on display at the end of the video was that of Tommy Gibson, who was the youngest of the featured kids. Well, by the time 1994 rolled around, Judy decided to separate from Larry by packing up her car and leaving the state with her daughters. She would later claim that the breaking point in the relationship was when they got into a heated argument where Larry started blaming Judy for Tommy's disappearance and accused her of not watching him closely enough. Judy and the kids traveled to the town of Persia, Iowa, in order to stay with Larry's half-sister, Debbie Kalick, while Larry remained in Montana and relocated to the town of Townsend, where he moved in with his grandmother and found work as an insurance salesman. Well, on April the 14th, it was announced that Larry had been arrested in Townsend after an Oregon grand jury formally indicted him on the charges of intentional murder and murder by abuse. Even though Tommy had still not been found, investigators built a case against Larry after his daughter Karen changed her original story about having seen Tommy get abducted by an unidentified couple. According to Julie, only 11 days after she and her children moved in with Debbie Kalick, Karen suddenly shared a news story about having looked out her bedroom window and seeing her father get angry at her brother and physically abuse him. She said that Larry pushed Tommy and hit him across the cheek while holding his hands behind his back, and he then proceeded to hit the boy 3 more times before he went limp and fell to the ground. Larry then put Tommy into the back of his patrol car and drove away, and when he returned to the carport sometime later, Tommy was no longer in the vehicle. Carrie then witnessed Larry break a branch off a tree and sweep away the tire marks in the dirt. This whole incident caused Karen to become so frightened of her father that she hid inside her bedroom closet and stayed silent about what she had seen. After Karen shared this story with both Judy and Debbie, they contacted the Oregon State Police, and this soon paved the way to Larry being indicted and arrested for Tommy's murder. He was subsequently extradited back to Oregon and remained incarcerated in the Douglas County Jail to await his trial, which began in Douglas County Circuit Court in Roseburg in January of 1995. Instead of the Oregon State Police's original theory about Tommy being killed by a stray bullet, the prosecution presented a new variation on this scenario. They alleged that when Larry left his home to go jogging, Tommy attempted to follow him, but Larry told him to go back to the house and wait for his sister to come out. Shortly thereafter, Larry fired the shot into the cat, but after hearing the noise, Tommy walked into the yard to see what was going on. When Larry spotted his son, he became angry at him for disobeying him, so he picked up Tommy and took him to the carport. He then flew into a violent rage in which he hit Tommy multiple times and wound up killing him. When Larry noticed that Karen had been watching him through her bedroom window, Larry placed Tommy's body inside his patrol car and drove it behind a wood pile on his property. He then proceeded to put Tommy's body inside a large white plastic garbage bag and placed it inside the trunk before he headed out jogging. The prosecution theorized that Larry may have used this additional time to figure out a location to dispose of Tommy's body before he returned home, and this entire series of events would have taken around 47 minutes. Larry then called the sheriff's office to report his son missing, and later that day, he drove the patrol car off his property in order to dispose of Tommy's body. Whenever Larry shot stray cats on his property, he would often place their bodies inside trash bags and then dump them inside a garbage can at one of the rest areas on Interstate 5. The prosecution theorized that Larry was planning to do the same thing to Tommy, but decided against it when he arrived at the rest area and discovered there were too many cars there. Instead, Larry drove down a nearby logging road known as Swamp Creek Road and disposed of Tommy's body in a remote gravel pit, as investigators claim there was one occasion when they took Larry to this spot and he reportedly acted upset and nervous. Since there was no body or any physical evidence, the case against Larry would rely heavily on his daughter's testimony against him. While Karen was 8 years old at this point, she had only been 4 years old when she supposedly witnessed Tommy's murder, so the defense would argue that her account was unreliable. In the weeks following her brother's disappearance, Karen had been placed under hypnosis by law enforcement in order to improve her memory, but she never said anything about seeing her father hit Tommy. In fact, Larry had consented to the hypnosis and allowed Karen to be questioned by police detectives, a child welfare worker, and a therapist, and the defense argued that Larry never would have done that if he was responsible for Tommy's death. When Karen took the stand to testify, she was clutching a teddy bear in her arms and claimed that when Larry realized she had seen him kill Tommy, he told her that if she did not keep her mouth shut, she would either go to jail or the same thing that happened to Tommy might happen to her as well. As a result, Karen stayed silent about it, though a few months later, Larry would order her to tell police that she saw Tommy get abducted by a couple in a pickup truck. She said she was too afraid to tell anyone about what she saw her father do until she moved to Iowa with her mother and was over 1,000 miles away from him. When asked under cross-examination if she still loved her father, Karen simply replied, no. Judy took the stand to testify and said that she did not believe her ex-husband had anything to do with Tommy's disappearance until she heard Karen's story. However, she also acknowledged that Larry had been physically abusive towards her and their children throughout the course of their marriage. At the time Tommy went missing, Judy was taking college classes, which meant that Larry had to care for their kids more frequently than usual, and this apparently caused his stress levels to rise. Judy recounted one incident which took place before Tommy went missing, when she came into the kitchen and found Tommy screaming and lying on the floor next to his fallen high chair, with Larry standing over him. Tommy also had red marks on his face, and when Judy told Larry not to hit the children so hard, he replied that he did not believe he hit Tommy too hard. She also said that Larry often pushed Tommy whenever the boy got into his way, which left him with welts and bruises, and there was an additional incident where Larry pushed Karen to the ground because she interfered with his television watching. For his part, Larry took the stand to testify in his own defense, and did not deny that he disciplined his children and had spanked them hard a few times. But he argued that his discipline was not excessive or frequent, and that he never crossed the line into abuse. Larry's half-sister, Debbie Kalick, would testify that a few months after Tommy went missing, she had received a frantic, tearful phone call from Larry, who confessed to having killed his son. The call apparently took place on the same day when investigators first openly expressed their suspicions towards Larry, so he said he was worried that Judy would never forgive him for it and told Debbie that he might need money to post bail if he was arrested. Years later, when Judy and her three daughters moved in with Debbie, she claimed there was an incident when they were watching an episode of The Flintstones on television which showed a picture of a large hole. Upon seeing this, Karen supposedly said that she didn't want her daddy to put her in a large hole like he did with Tommy. And shortly thereafter, Karen finally shared her story about having witnessed Tommy's death, and when Debbie asked her to repeat it a few times, she was struck by how consistent the story was and how many vivid details Karen remembered, which is why Debbie found her account to be credible. Additional testimony was also provided by a former babysitter of the Gibsons, who claimed that she looked after Karen shortly after Tommy went missing, and heard the girl state that her father had, quote-unquote, broke her brother. Oh, and the trial finally resolved the mystery of the aforementioned spot-in-the-road letter, as an Azalea resident named Warren Deschler took the stand to reveal that the anonymous writer was likely his wife, who had passed away in 1993. According to Deschler, he and his wife had been camping on the Oregon coast on the day of Tommy's disappearance, but at some point, she claimed that she had a psychic vision of the event and decided to write an anonymous letter to the authorities recounting what she had seen. As far as I can tell, the contents of the letter have still never been revealed to the public, but it does not sound like Mrs. Deschler had any connection to the Gibsons or any personal knowledge of what happened to Tommy, so the letter was probably nothing more than a red herring. The trial lasted 6 weeks before it went to the jury, and on March the 16th, after deliberating for a total of 14 hours over the course of 2 days, they found Larry guilty. If Larry had been convicted on the charges of intentional murder and murder by abuse, he could have received up to 10 years in prison for each charge, but the jury instead decided to convict him on the lesser charge of second-degree manslaughter. Larry's defense attorney, Alan Scott, told the press, quote, "I wasn't surprised at the verdict. It's what I expected. But in a way, it's a defense verdict because I know he's not going to do a substantial period of time in jail. End quote. While the usual sentencing guidelines for that charge would have been around 16 to 18 months, the trial judge decided to hand down a sentence of 3 years, which Larry would serve at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. But since Larry had spent nearly a year in jail awaiting trial, this would count as time served towards a sentence. Judy openly expressed her disappointment about this, stating, quote, "I would have thought Tommy's life was worth more than 2 years. He only gets to serve 2. That's nothing to him." End quote. While a number of people hoped that Larry would finally admit to what he had done and reveal the location of Tommy's body, he continued to maintain his innocence and said that he would help search for his son once he finished serving his time. After having some additional time shaved off his sentence for good behavior, Larry was released from the Oregon State Penitentiary in September of 1996, after only having served 18 months there, and he subsequently moved back to Montana. Larry continued to insist that he was wrongly convicted, and in 2001, he even went so far as to start a website for Tommy in order to spread awareness about his son's case and seek the public's help with finding him. Following Larry's conviction, the authorities had closed the investigation into Tommy's disappearance, as they still believed that Larry was the guilty party and would not be pursuing any further leads. But unfortunately, after 3 decades, Tommy Gibson's remains have still not been found, and the actual circumstances of his disappearance continue to remain up for debate. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this is a case which has haunted me since I saw it featured on Unsolved Mysteries over 30 years ago, and since it is now technically considered to be solved, I debated about whether or not it was appropriate to feature it on The Trail Went Cold. But even though Larry Gibson was charged and convicted of being responsible for Tommy's death, he has never stopped maintaining his innocence, and most importantly, Tommy's body has still not been found. I've covered a couple of missing persons cases on this podcast which have wound up being solved without the victims being found, such as the disappearances of Pamela Butler, Bethany Decker, and Rini and Andrew McRae. But the circumstances of those cases were quite different, as even though it was determined that the victims' remains were probably not recoverable, you still felt there was a resolution and that some sort of justice had been served. Here, regardless of how you feel about the prime suspect's guilt or innocence, I think we can all agree that the conclusion was incredibly unsatisfying. If Larry Gibson was not actually guilty, then an innocent father got railroaded and had to serve time in prison for a crime he did not commit. But if Larry was guilty, then he got off way too easy, as he only served a total of 29 months behind bars, and that certainly does not feel like a punishment which fit the crime. Truthfully, I almost would have preferred if the authorities had held off on filing charges against him. Since he has already been tried and convicted and served his time, Larry can never be charged with this crime again, even if Tommy's remains are found or if new evidence were to surface. So if Larry did this, he's been able to spend the past 27 years living a normal life, whereas if he had never been charged, he might still be looking over his shoulder today and living in constant fear and paranoia that he could be arrested at any time. As it is right now, the investigation into Tommy's disappearance is officially closed, but I still think there are a lot of unanswered questions which deserve discussion and analysis. Now, I'll state right up front that one of my biggest pet peeves in the true crime world is when people automatically assume that a missing or murdered victim's spouse or family member is guilty based on how they come across in interviews with the media. I mean, if there's strong evidence to indicate they're involved, that would be one thing, but there are many amateur sleuths who will immediately become suspicious of someone if they are not acting what they perceive to be as emotional enough. That can often be an unfair assessment, since there is no universal reaction to tragedy, as different people will react and grieve in different ways. And I'm someone who prefers to assess a case by the evidence rather than the emotions or lack thereof from the people involved. All that being said, however, there is something about Larry Gibson's interview on Unsolved Mysteries which has always unsettled me, as I can't think of too many other examples of a parent coming across as less emotional over their missing child. Granted, Larry may have just been a very introverted, unemotional person in general, and this was his way of dealing with things, but he speaks in a very flat, monotone voice, and his demeanor gives off the vibe that Tommy's disappearance is more of an annoyance and inconvenience to him rather than a traumatic ordeal. Granted, given that he was being accused of being responsible for what happened, I can understand Larry's frustration if he was actually innocent, and if the only evidence against him was his perceived lack of emotion, then I wouldn't judge him as harshly. But once you hear about his other troubling actions in this case, and the allegations of abuse that he inflicted upon Tommy and his siblings, Larry's interview becomes quite unnerving to watch. What's even more surprising is that Larry himself apparently took the initiative to contact Unsolved Mysteries and ask them to feature Tommy's story, which would be an incredibly brazen thing to do if he was guilty. He may have done so in hopes that this would help him clear his name, but I'm not sure Larry realized just how much worse his appearance was going to make him look. If you go back and read some of the earliest media coverage of this case, you wouldn't assume that there was any reason to believe that Larry was responsible. At one point, the local press published an article announcing that Larry had undertaken a new initiative in which he began fingerprinting local children. He figured it would be a good idea for the authorities to have these kids' prints on file in case they ever went missing someday, and Larry said that he had even taken Tommy's prints a few weeks before he disappeared. Given that he was a police officer, I think it took many people in the community by complete surprise when the Oregon State Police publicly named him as the prime suspect. But there were people who admitted that they always felt something was off about Larry from the very beginning, such as when he advised a group of searchers not to bother looking for Tommy because it was about to start snowing. Even when Larry went on trial years later, it sounds like opinions in Douglas County were still sharply divided about him. A Glendale resident named Terry Reed told the press, quote, "It used to be a saying that you don't talk about sex and religion. Well, in this town, you don't talk about sex, religion, and Larry Gibson. It gets into some pretty heated discussions," end quote. It's also worth noting that in the days following Tommy's disappearance, Larry sat down with his electric guitar and recorded a song for his son with such lyrics as, "Tommy, where are you, Tommy?" He then called around to all the local radio and television stations to ask if they could play the song. If Larry was a truly innocent, grieving father, then this would probably seem like a very touching gesture, but in retrospect, knowing what we know now, it comes across as a bit odd. I mentioned earlier that in the years following his release from prison, Larry put up a website for Tommy asking for assistance to help solve his disappearance. But around the same time, Larry also put up a separate website for himself in which he attempted to promote his new career as a country music singer. Now, I wouldn't say the guy was Garth Brooks or anything, but it looks like Larry did spend years touring and performing at numerous venues throughout Montana, and he even recorded and sold some CDs. These websites for Tommy and Larry were put up in 2001 and were around for many years, but it looks like they're no longer functional. But I do remember seeing a picture of Larry on his website in which he was pretty much completely unrecognizable from his Unsolved Mysteries appearance, as he was now dressed like a cowboy and had a thick white beard. And while it's since been taken down, I also once found a YouTube channel containing handheld videos of Larry's country music performances. And interestingly enough, I recall that the comment sections on all these YouTube videos just happened to be disabled, almost as if Larry did not want anyone bringing up his controversial past. Larry's post-release attempt at a country music career makes me wonder if he had ulterior motives when he recorded that song for Tommy back in 1991, as he wanted to have it played on the radio and TV. Now, since Larry has served his time and cannot be sent to prison again for anything related to Tommy's death, you might be wondering why he simply couldn't just fess up and reveal the location of Tommy's remains if he was guilty. Well, that's probably because he'd still have to live with the stigma of admitting that he killed his 2-year-old son, so you can understand why he would continue maintaining his innocence to try and preserve his reputation. Of course, I know that many of you listeners out there are animal lovers, and I'm sure that once you heard the detail about Larry shooting a cat, you probably didn't care if he was innocent or guilty and wanted to lock him up and throw away the key just for that. It's kind of similar to when many people heard the story of Stephen Avery throwing a cat into a fire at the beginning of Making a Murderer and developed an immediate dislike for him. Well, Larry said that it was common practice to shoot at stray cats on his property because they could be feral and there was nothing else he could do with them, I was surprised to learn that he actually wound up shooting his neighbor's cat by mistake. Even more surprising was that the cat belonged to the family of Jeanette Klein, who would later provide an eyewitness account which seemed to support Larry's innocence. That was a remarkably considerate thing for her to do, considering that Larry killed her daughter-in-law's cat and pretty much just said, "Oops, sorry." What's particularly controversial about this case is that the initial theory presented by the authorities was that Tommy may have accidentally been killed by a stray bullet when Larry fired the shot into the cat, and that he decided to cover up what he had done by disposing of Tommy's body. But when Larry went on trial and was convicted years later, the prosecution presented an entirely different scenario where Larry beat his son to death in a violent rage and covered up the crime. I already had a negative impression of Larry based on how the Unsolved Mysteries segment portrayed this case, but if the stray bullet theory was true, then at least you could say that Tommy's death was a freak accident. However, once I learned that Larry may have actually fatally beaten his 2-year-old son, my disgust for him somehow multiplied by thousands. If this is what actually happened, then Larry deserved to rot in prison for the rest of his life, but since the case against him was based almost entirely on the testimony of his daughter Karen, who was only 4 years old at that time and had changed her original story, I can see why some people may have been skeptical of this scenario and felt that the evidence against Larry was not strong enough to convict him beyond a reasonable doubt. And I find it interesting how even though Larry was indicted on the charges of intentional murder and murder by abuse, the jury made the decision to convict him on the lesser charge of second-degree manslaughter. I wouldn't go so far as to say that this was intentional murder, since I doubt that Larry planned on killing his son, but if the scenario presented at trial was true, then I'd say that Tommy's death definitely qualifies as an example of murder by abuse. But if Tommy had actually been killed by a stray bullet, then this would probably fit the second-degree manslaughter charge. So this makes me think the jury did feel that Larry was responsible for Tommy's death, but did not necessarily believe the prosecution's theory. After he was convicted, Larry spoke with the press and expressed his surprise with the verdict when he stated, quote, "I don't understand their decision at all. I think they should have gone all or nothing. The way they decided it, I'm kind of pregnant," end quote. So let's explore the events on the day Tommy went missing. The story which Larry has always stuck to is that he last saw his son playing on the front porch before he went off jogging, but by the time he returned, Tommy was gone. Of course, the biggest red flag is that Larry claimed that he was gone for 47 minutes, but when investigators mapped out the route he says he took, they determined that he really should have only been gone for about 20 minutes max. If it really took him 47 minutes to only cover 1 mile, then I don't think what he was doing would really qualify as jogging. I hate having to focus so much on the murder of an animal, but unfortunately, it is an extremely crucial detail in this case. It was confirmed that Larry did shoot the Klein family's cat that day, and he claimed this happened right as he was crossing over a fence to leave his yard. So the original theory from investigators is that Larry may not have even realized that the bullet hit Tommy until after he returned, meaning that he may have spent about 20 minutes jogging and the next 27 minutes or so covering up what he did and putting Tommy's body in the trunk of his patrol car. Now, you might be thinking that it violates the laws of physics for a stray bullet to pass through an animal's body and then hit a child who is about 100 feet away. But as we've seen in cases like the Rhonda Hinson murder, which was also covered on Unsolved Mysteries and episode number 4 of The Trail Went Cold, sometimes these freak occurrences with bullets do occur. It is very odd that Larry told contradictory stories about searching for the shell casing from the shot he fired, as he apparently told one investigator that he found the casing before claiming that he didn't. During a search of the Gibson residence, a shell casing was found in a dresser underneath some children's underwear, and while that's admittedly a weird place to put it, I'm not sure if it was ever conclusively established if it was the same casing from the shot fired into the cat. If the casing was connected to Tommy's death, I'm not sure why Larry would keep it around rather than just get rid of it. Of course, there are still some holes with the stray bullet theory. For years, Larry's wife Judy supported him and maintained that while she recalled hearing Larry's gunshot from inside their home that morning, she then heard the sound of Tommy playing outside immediately thereafter, which would seemingly debunk the idea of him being killed by a stray bullet. Another issue with this theory is that the following day, Larry approached Jennifer Klein and flat out admitted that he may have shot her cat. If the same shot killed Tommy, why wouldn't Larry have disposed of the cat's body as well and pretended that the whole incident never happened? Well, Larry's story is that when he fired the shot, the cat took off through some weeds down a hill, so he initially assumed that he had missed. It's possible that the cat traveled a great distance before it died, but Larry was unable to find the body. So he decided to preemptively tell Jennifer Klein about what he did, in case she wound up discovering the cat's body, and sure enough, that's exactly what happened. However, by the time Larry went on trial, the authorities adjusted their theory to Tommy heading into the yard after he heard his father fire the shot, and Larry became so enraged about his son disobeying him that he wound up beating the child to death. If this is what actually happened, then it could explain why Judy said she could still hear Tommy playing outside on the porch right after the shot was fired. And if Karen's account of witnessing her father kill Tommy is true, then this could mean that Larry spent that entire 47-minute window covering up what he did. Of course, if this all took place right outside the house, you have to wonder if Larry would have been able to pull this off without any of the adults noticing. Judy always claimed that she believed Larry was innocent until they got separated 3 years later, and Karen finally shared her account about witnessing him kill Tommy. If Karen was terrified of her father, it makes total sense that she would remain silent about this story and not open up until she was living in Iowa over 1,000 miles away from him. But the argument pushed forward by Larry's defense team is that the timing of this whole situation was awfully convenient, as they believe that Judy may have coached Karen into sharing this story to get revenge against Larry for their separation. Well, regardless of whether or not you believe Larry is guilty of causing Tommy's death, it does sound like there was a lot of domestic violence in that household and that it got progressively worse after Tommy went missing. If you search online, you can find a legal appeal that Larry's defense team had filed with the Court of Appeals of Oregon, which details a number of the allegations about him being abusive not only towards Tommy, but his 3 daughters as well. It sounds like he could lose his temper at a moment's notice, and Judy even recounted an incident where she returned home from the hospital after giving birth to their youngest daughter, Katrina, and noticing red marks on the leg of her second youngest daughter, Lisa, who only would have been about a year old at that time. While Larry tried to say that the marks were rug burns, Judy said that she later witnessed him hit Lisa when she got into his way, and it left similar-looking red marks. If these allegations were true, then it's apparent that Larry just did not have the patience or temperament to raise children, so you can definitely believe he was capable of doing what Karen accused him of. But did Judy have any knowledge of what Larry did to Tommy before they were separated? She claimed that she went outside about 10 minutes after Larry left on his jog and noticed that Tommy was gone, but if Karen's story is true, Larry would have moved his patrol car behind a woodpile on the property by that point and was in the midst of placing Tommy's body inside a trash bag. Would he really have been able to do this undetected if Judy was outside? Did she not notice that Larry's patrol car wasn't parked where it was supposed to be? Or did Larry already place Tommy's body in the trunk, return the patrol car to its original parking spot, and then go jogging before Judy went outside? While Judy technically did pass a polygraph during the early stages of the investigation, the results apparently showed that she may have known more than she was letting on. This did not necessarily mean she was lying or personally witnessed anything, but she may have secretly suspected Larry, but was too frightened of him to say anything. However, if Judy believed that Larry killed Tommy and had no evidence to prove it, could she have coached Karen into sharing this story? Another wild card in this case is Larry's half-brother Michael, who was staying at the Gibson residence during this time period and was present on the morning Tommy disappeared. As far as I can tell, Michael was never interviewed by the media, and I've only seen him get mentioned briefly in a few articles about this case. One reason the Oregon State Police became suspicious of Larry is because when they confronted him with the theory about Tommy being killed by the stray bullet, Larry said that it was quote-unquote possible it could have happened that way, and even made an odd statement about how Michael could have moved the body. Wait, so was Larry trying to imply that he could have unknowingly shot Tommy with a straight bullet, and while he was out jogging, Michael just decided to dispose of Tommy's body without his knowledge? That scenario doesn't make any sense, but it almost sounds like Larry was trying to cast suspicion towards his brother. For a while, I actually wondered if Michael might have been the author of the anonymous spot in the road letter, and that perhaps he witnessed something incriminating that day and wanted to clear his conscience, but was too scared to come forward. However, now that we know that it was written by an outsider who had a so-called psychic vision, it sounds like the letter has no relevance to this case at all. But while we don't know much about Michael, we do know that Larry's half-sister Debbie took in Judy and the kids after they left him, and Debbie flat-out testified against Larry at his trial. Debbie confirmed she saw Karen open up about witnessing her father kill Tommy, and that the child did so without any provocation or coaching. In addition, Debbie also claimed that in the months following Tommy's disappearance, she received a tearful phone call from Larry, who admitted to having killed him. It's pretty damning when your own sibling testifies against you like that, so I'd be very curious to learn about the dynamics in that family and what kind of relationships Larry had with his half-sister and half-brother. But the fact that Debbie was willing to provide corroboration for Judy gives off the impression that Judy was not just some vindictive ex who coached her daughter into falsely accusing Larry of murder. So one of the first things that caused investigators to become suspicious of Larry is that in the hours following Tommy's disappearance, Larry was told he did not have to report for duty at the sheriff's office to work his scheduled shift, but he still got dressed in his police uniform and left the property in his patrol car. And even more damningly, he initially denied ever leaving the property that day and only changed his story once investigators told him that there were 7 miles on the odometer which could not be accounted for. While Larry claimed that he went to check out some nearby rest areas to see if Tommy might have been taken there, it's odd that he wouldn't have said this in the first place or told his fellow officers where he was going. It's believed that Larry had been keeping Tommy's body in the trunk and used this opportunity to slip off the property in order to dispose of him. I think the reason Larry changed into his uniform is because he knew that if any witnesses saw him driving a patrol car while he was dressed in civilian clothing, it probably would have attracted attention and caused suspicion. Larry's story was that he spent about 10 to 15 minutes searching each of the two rest areas, but while it's unclear exactly how much time he was away from his property, we know he couldn't have gone far. When you look at the discrepancy with the odometer, and also take into account the distance Larry would have required to drive back home, the maximum amount he could have traveled is around 3.5 miles. Investigators suspect that Larry disposed of Tommy's body in a remote gravel pit located on a nearby logging road, but I'm not sure how thoroughly this gravel pit was searched. If Larry was gone from his property for less than an hour, I question whether he would have had enough time to dispose of Tommy's body so thoroughly that it hasn't been found in over 30 years. However, at Larry's trial, the prosecution tried to account for this by pushing forward the theory that a bear could have carried off Tommy's body from the gravel pit, so by the time anyone started searching that area, there may not have been anything left to find. I guess if there's one reason why I might be skeptical of this theory, is that I'm not sure why Larry wouldn't have gotten rid of Tommy's body before he reported him missing. It just seems like a major risk to keep him on the property while a search effort is taking place. What if tracking dogs had been brought to the scene who were able to detect Tommy's scent from inside the trunk? But on the other hand, if Judy and Michael had no knowledge or involvement with what happened to Tommy, I'm sure they would have found it suspicious if Larry left the property in his patrol car, as they noticed the boy was missing at around noon, and Larry was not scheduled to report to work until 2 p.m. But what if Larry was innocent all along, and Tommy really was the victim of a stranger abduction? Well, that's the theory Leary has always tried to push forward, as he claimed that Karen told him she witnessed a man and a woman drive up to his residence in a yellow pickup truck and kidnap Tommy. Well, Leary's defense attorneys accused Judy of coaching Karen into sharing her story about her father killing Tommy, Leary has been accused of coaching Karen to share her story about seeing these two kidnappers. Now, to be fair, Karen's story was somewhat supported by the account from Jeanette Klein, who recalled seeing a similar-looking pickup truck turning up the driveway leading to the Gibsons' property on the same morning Tommy went missing. And while Jeanette never specifically described seeing a man and a woman, she said she saw two silhouettes inside the truck. I certainly do not believe Jeanette is intentionally lying, especially when you consider that Leary shot her family's cat, so I can't imagine she would go out of her way to protect him. But I think it's possible that she may have been mistaken about the date, or did see a truck on that particular morning, and it has no significance to this case. If Karen had shared a story about a pickup truck first, and it was later corroborated by Jeanette, I would put more credence into these sightings. However, the fact that Karen did not mention the truck until months after Jeanette reported her sighting does lend credence to the idea that Leary could have taken the details from Jeanette's story and used them to coach Karen into sharing a similar story. Yes, you could argue that Karen was so traumatized by what she saw that she remained silent about it for months, but it seems convenient that Karen never said anything until after investigators informed Leary that they considered him to be the prime suspect. So I'm sure it would have been in Leary's best interest to create an alternate narrative involving these boogeyman kidnappers. While it's certainly not impossible that a stranger abduction took place, my main problem with that theory is the sheer remoteness of where the Gibsons' residence was located. Not only was it in a rural area in the middle of nowhere, but anyone who visited the Gibsons would need to turn off Azalea Glen Road and drive down a lengthy driveway before they reached the carport where Tommy was allegedly abducted. So it's not like some random passerby could have just been driving down this road and noticed Tommy playing alone outside. If this couple in the pickup truck were looking for a random child to abduct, the odds against them arriving at this remote residence while Tommy just happens to be playing outside unattended have to be astronomical. Even if by chance these abductors knew Tommy and were specifically targeting him, how could they have predicted that he would be alone without any adult supervision at this particular time? I know that Judy said that she recalled hearing what sounded like a vehicle idling near the residence during this time period, but if Karen's story is true, then I wonder if Judy might have heard Leary's patrol car idling near the woodpile. Overall, I really just do not buy this stranger abduction theory, which means that the only other logical explanation which does not involve Leary being the perpetrator is if Tommy happened to wander away from the property and died of exposure inside the woods somewhere. While a massive search effort was performed, we've seen many cases where searchers have had no luck finding a missing victim in a remote wilderness area, only for the victim's remains to turn up in the exact same area years later because they had been missed the first time around. I suppose you can't completely discount the idea that Tommy wandered off and his remains are still out there somewhere, but this wouldn't account for many of the other suspicious actions on Leary's part. If Tommy really did die of exposure and there was no criminal activity involved, why would Karen have shared this story about the couple in the pickup truck? I seriously doubt that a 4-year-old is going to come up with a story like that on their own, so I definitely think she was coached and there would be no need for Leary to do something like that if his son simply wandered off and died due to misadventure. I do agree with this statement from the Oregon State Police's original affidavit, quote, "The likelihood of Tommy Gibson being alive and meeting any fate other than death at the hands of Leary Gibson is extremely small," end quote. But was the story shared by Karen the actual truth about what happened? While I do acknowledge that the memories of a 4-year-old can be unreliable, I do believe that out of all the many different theories presented in this case, the scenario shared by the prosecution at Leary's trial is the one which seems to make the most sense. I am a bit torn about the jury's decision to convict Leary of second-degree manslaughter, because while part of me wishes that he had gotten a stronger sentence, I do have to admit that there's not much actual evidence of foul play, other than Karen's story, Debbie's account of Leary's alleged confession over the phone, and a documented history of violence to indicate that Larry was capable of killing his son. While there's no way I believe that Larry is completely innocent, I guess there is a small possibility that Tommy's death was a freak accident caused by a stray bullet rather than a violent beating, which is why the jury felt more comfortable convicting Larry on the lesser charge. But even so, the fact that Larry covered up what he did and denied his son a proper burial deserved punishment. While I'm sure that serving nearly 3 years behind bars was no picnic, Larry has been able to live the past 27 years of his life as a free man without admitting any culpability, and that's a very bittersweet feeling for those who want justice for Tommy. It bothers me that this poor boy is still out there somewhere, and I am sickened by the theory that Larry may have dumped his son's body in a gravel pit where he was later carried off by a bear. Even if there's nothing that can be done in this case from a legal standpoint, it would still be nice to recover Tommy's remains. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Tommy Gibson, please contact the Douglas County Sheriff's Office at 541-440-4450. That's 541-440-4450. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives and for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released a bonus episode about a wanted fugitive named Carl Alfred Etter, who was convicted of the murders of a mother and her four children when he was only 16 years old, but wound up escaping from prison in 1974 and has not been seen since. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1988 disappearance of Elizabeth Campbell. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives.
I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are ThrashMetalShow.com, SVeja, Corin F., and Tina S. Thank you all so much for your support.
I wanted to remind everyone that later this year, The Trail Went Cold has been booked to appear on Podcast Row at two separate Crime Con events. The American Crime Con, which is taking place at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel in Nashville from May the 31st until June the 2nd, and Crime Con UK, which is taking place at 133 Houndsditch in London on September the 21st and 22nd. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a specialized promo code to get a 10% discount at both events, so please visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COOL24. Once again, that's crimecon.com and crimecon.co.uk, and the promo code is COOL24 for 10% off tickets to both events. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composed the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.